Tonight's lecture or exhortation will be given by Brother Adam Winfrey, and he has titled it, Making God Happy. Brother Adam Winfrey.
My name is Adam Winfrey. I am from Richmond, Virginia. I am 28 years old. I was baptized approximately 7 years ago. Last week, I was at Virginia Youth Camp, and if anyone here has kids that are ages about 7 to 15, Virginia Youth Camp, it's been around for ages and ages and ages, and it's just a good place to send your kids, so next summer, just keep that in mind when you're planning out your summer for your children. And some of the campers are here this week, as I look for the plug. And I told them I was going to be exhorting tonight, and one of them said that she'd probably fall asleep. And the other one said she probably wouldn't understand anything that I was going to talk about. So, Saturday, Brother Seth and I, Seth Bubbles, who exhorted on Sunday, were driving here, and he and I both knew that we were exhorting. And we stopped somewhere, and he asked me, kind of point blank, what are you speaking about this weekend? And I kind of gave him a quick summary, and he paused for a second, he looked at me, he's like, oh, me too. And I kind of developed, like, it didn't show up. Sorry. Well, I had a graph here that basically said that it's more likely as the week goes on that someone's going to cover your topic. And when Brother Dave got up on Sunday morning and kind of talked about what he was going to talk about, that was basically also kind of what I was going to talk about. And last night, same thing, and this morning, kind of same thing. So it's good. And last night we talked about this problem, because no one really wants to hear the same thing again and again. And we came up with a solution that I could plausibly talk about a different subject that no one was going to talk about. But in order to keep the blue book more correct, we're just going to stick to my original title. So, a few years ago, some of my Christadelphian friends and I, as we often did, were hanging out. And one of them posted a question to the group. If God never offered the hope of the kingdom, the resurrection, if there was no afterlife, would you still serve God? And I instantly thought, yes, of course I would. I wasn't really serving God for the kingdom anyway. I served him because I loved him. I believed that God wanted to have a relationship with me. And knowing the stories of Abraham and Enoch and David, I understood that having a close relationship with God was attainable. Abraham was said to be God's friend, and how awesome would it be for the creator of the universe to call you his friend? And we have a choice to become his children, but how much more awesome would it be if he called you that? To know that not only does God love you, but he also really likes who you are and what you're doing with your life. And so I thought about God as a father, and I thought about him as a possible friend. And just like any friend, I wanted God to be happy. I wanted to make God happy. And many of my friends, actually all of them, except for one, had answers that were based around serving God because they loved him, which is similar to mine. But the friend who asked the question just shook their head, said, not me, I'm in it for the reward. And that answer startled a few of us. It didn't make sense. It was selfish. It was against what we thought was a very basic Christian understanding that serving God out of love was the only way to serve. And to at least me, the kingdom seemed to be more of a good consequence to serving than God rather than an actual reward. But I talked with him several more times, and over time, though I didn't agree with him, I believe that I underestimated what the hope of the kingdom was in my life. And I was, though still uncomfortable, and I disagree with him with my friend's answer, I believe that he better understood how valuable the hope of the kingdom was. So I would like to talk a little bit about serving God out of love and serving God for the reward, because I believe if you get a good grasp of what these two things are, they will harmonize and make your God, walk with God much easier. So when I was beginning this study, I embarrassingly had a difficult time trying to think where in the Bible we read about having a relationship with God until I remembered Mark chapter 12, verses 28 through 34, which I'll read for you really quickly. We're all very familiar with this. It's the where the lawyer asks, what commandment is the most important? Or the scribe. When one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, and asked, which commandment is the most important of all? Jesus answered, the most important is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And there is no other commandment greater than these. And the scribe said to him, you are right, teacher. You have truly said he is one, and that there is no other beside him. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of heaven. And after that, no one dared ask him any more questions. And this gives us a good direction of what we need to do on our part, but it doesn't complete the picture. Because this isn't a one-way relationship we have with God. What we need to add to this thought are other verses, such as James chapter 4, verse 8, which reads, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. And also 1 John chapter 4, verse 19, we love because he first loved us. God has instituted a loving two-way relationship with you. And the call of love to him should be our half of the connection. And I don't mean to be blasphemous, and I don't think I am, because what I'm about to say isn't true about God. But what use is a God that doesn't care about you? What kind of relationship can you have if you serve someone out of compulsion with no real benefit to you? It's sort of like paying taxes. No one wants to pay taxes, but you have to, and if you don't, something bad's going to happen. And we have to be careful, because God can appear uncaring and sort of like that when you pick out certain verses in the Bible where God seems to be demanding compulsory service, such as in Zechariah chapter 14, verse 16 and 17, where it talks about when the kingdom is set up and Jesus is reigning on earth, then everyone who survives all the nations that have come against Jerusalem should go up year after year to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths. And if any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, then there will be no rain on them. And a lot of the law is like that too. It is very process-oriented on what the Israelites had to do to please God and the bad consequences that didn't. But what we often are not remembered are the blessings that if the Israelites and other peoples did what was right. And the blessings weren't just an absence of negative things, such as famine or war. There was also promises of abundance of good things. To give you an idea of what their extent, the blessings were almost accurately portrayed in Israel at its peak when it was under Solomon, with the surplus of wealth. The land that God had promised them was almost, they almost had all of it at that point. And they were at peace with every nation up until near the end of Solomon's reign, when he started to do things that he shouldn't be doing. And when you grasp this relationship with God, it becomes easier to serve, and it becomes very fulfilling and happy when you serve. When you do things that please God, such as in Micah 6, 8. And it's good, you get a good feeling when you know that you're having a lasting effect on people's lives, and more importantly, a lasting effect on God. And this is what I mean when I say that I wanted to make God happy. I wanted to have this lasting effect on God. So in the kingdom, God can tell me, Adam, I really appreciated it when you did the X, Y, and Z that really made me happy. And you probably have your own way of saying this. But I do think it's important to recognize happiness as an emotion of God. And I think it's just as important for us to want him to have that as much as we don't want to hurt him. When you have a loving relationship with God, it is important to remember that just like any relationship, it can wane. There may be periods when you are amazed with everything that God is, and there are times where you may be indifferent. And there may be times when you are scared of Him. And there may even be times when you don't like Him. And obviously, we want to be in the first of that spectrum. Humans generally like good relationships, and a good relationship with God is no different. And if you want to have a good relationship with God, but don't, the solution to whatever problem there is between you and Him can't ever really come quick enough. And that can wear on you. And I don't think it is the primary reason, but I do think it is a great secondary effect of the hope of an afterlife, of our reward, of the kingdom, is that it gives us something to hold on to in times of trouble. It is like a beacon from God that shows us that He really loves us and really intends to show us how much so. And God doesn't try to downplay the importance of the kingdom. And you can tell from verses like, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and its righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." And I don't think it's downplayed at all in our community either, but we can, as individuals, lose sight or even be unaware of its importance and its benefits to us. To go back to my story, the day I gave my answer, things weren't really going awesome for me. Compared to others, I was doing fairly well, but there were things in my life that weren't really working out, regardless of how hard I tried to change them. And the less selfish part of me began to notice that things weren't really going well for my friends and my spiritual family. People were dealing with sickness, broken relationships, depression, and death. People weren't succeeding in life. They were getting fired, couldn't find a job despite going to college and training, and they had money problems. And there was the hope for all of us that God would relieve us of our pains through some miracle. And it took me a long time to accept that this miracle that I was waiting for to fix my problems may just have to be the kingdom. And we all want relief from our pains now, but some of us can accept that these pains won't go away, like missing someone you love who has died until the kingdom comes. But it's difficult to stop wanting for God to heal our pains that can be changed now. Not that God wouldn't heal your problems now, but that is one of the more special things about the kingdom. It is a relief from the troubles in this life. And God, through Jesus, Jesus' apostles, and the prophets, thought that the kingdom was significant enough in our walk with Him to mention it many times, but also present it as a relief and as something to be desired, and not just as a mere good consequence for our service. Several places in the book of Isaiah, God tells us of a day when there will be peace, just one passage is Isaiah chapter 65, verse 25. "The wolf and the lamb shall graze together, the lion shall eat straw with the ox, and the dust shall be the serpent's food, and they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord." And in Matthew chapter 13, Jesus is recorded as had to have given three parables of how valuable the hope of the kingdom was. And just one of them is, "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it." When Jesus addresses the seven ecclesias in Revelation in chapters 2 and 3, he closes each address offering reward to the conqueror. And I believe that we can assume these rewards pertain to the kingdom. And Paul and other apostles often warn in their letters of what will keep people out of the kingdom, but also offer some more happy thoughts, such as Colossians chapter 1, verse 13 and 14. "He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." What is important is that we recognize the kingdom is not supposed to be an opportunity for personal gain, because God doesn't seem to appreciate people who are interested in Him for selfish reasons. And we have plenty of examples to support this, like the Pharisees, who used the law to honor themselves. Simon the magician in Acts, who wanted the ability to give the spirit gifts for his own selfish reasons. And Ananias and Sapphira, who were trying to cheat God by pretending they gave all their money to the church so they could have some of their finances taken care of by the church. And while it's good to have something to look forward to and to know that God ultimately has good intentions for us, it's still necessary for us that we pursue a good relationship with God. And I obviously can't tell you one simple thing that's going to fix if you have any problems, to fix any of them that you have with God, whether they're great or small. But I do think that there are a few simple things that you could do, that you can think about and apply to yourself as needed to make it a little easier. The first suggestion I have is, it seems rather simple. You need to find things about God that you like. Because obviously it's hard to love someone if there's nothing about them that you like. And this is more than loving God simply because he loves us. We should dwell on God, as the psalmist said in chapter 143, verse 5. I remember the days of old. I meditate on all that you have done. I ponder the work of your hands. And we do this with humans already. People are loved for things they create and do, whether it is a friend or a famous person. For example, if we find out someone has done something selfless, then we suddenly like them more. If we find, you know, something we like that someone's created, that just makes them more interesting. And this can create a closer bond between you and them. And the internet these days has made it really easy for people to find these things, to the point where they're almost anyone could become liked by someone for what they've contributed to this world. And just like we watch the internet to see what man has done, we should look around us to ponder what God has done. God came up with the idea for amazing things like northern lights, shooting stars, galaxies, blue whales, volcanoes, diamonds, flowers, tasty foods, good smells, wonderful sounds. And if you think about it, anything that in this world that's natural, that's amazing, that was a good idea that came from God. That's God saying, you know what I want to make? I want to make this because it's awesome. And people are going to enjoy it. And I didn't know whether or not I should bring this up or not, but I thought about it for a little bit and I decided to. And I didn't want to take this down a silly route or a strange route. And I don't know if they ever existed, and if they ever did exist, but it really, I love the fact that God probably created dinosaurs, because dinosaurs are freaking awesome. God had this idea, I'm going to make this one that has three horns, two coming out here, one coming out here, it has a beak, a little shield behind its head. I'm going to make this other one with 2 6-inch razor sharp claws that's featured in Jurassic Park. And I'm going to make this other one with a big head and a big body and a big tail and big teeth and big legs and itty bitty arms. And that's just really what interests me. Like, I love the fact that there are things that are in this world that I love, and God put them there for us to enjoy, and not just, you know, so they're going to like this, kind of like you give a kid something for Christmas that you don't really care about, like, oh, we got them a Nintendo 64, that's stupid, but they enjoy it. You know, God makes these things, and he loves them, and he sees them as good, and we're kind of jointly enjoying these things. And Brother Ray Pratt had a good point the other night when he told us that he and Sister Dana had just been to see the beauty that God has created in nature. And now that he was at Great Lakes, he saw the beautiful creatures that God was making us into. You know, through his law and through all the various things. Not just the fact that we exist, but God is making us into very, very beautiful creatures. And maybe most or none of these things that I just mentioned amaze you, but I'm sure you could come up with your own list of things that God about God that you like. And if you need help, there are hundreds of brothers and sisters here and elsewhere that would be glad to help you. So whether it's things that he's done, things that he's made, ways he has tried to change the world, how much effort he has put into getting some good out of us, or whatever else you could add, look for those things and think about these things. The second thing I have is more philosophical. It's a suggestion on how you should view God. Whenever we have a relationship with a person, we base it on at least two things: what we are told about them and experiences that we have with them. And we take these two pieces of information and develop a mental image of them. And we are constantly developing this mental image. You just think of somebody that you met several years ago and how much you knew them then and how much you know them now through things you've heard about them and just, you know, various things you've experienced with them. And because things are more official if they have a name, this is called a schema. And if Webster defines them, they're even more official. And I am not a psychologist, so I actually asked one of my psychologist friends who recently graduated from college if this was the name of it, and this is what he told me. If you are a psychologist, and this is incorrect, his name is Brother Colton Walker, and I'm not going to say it's his fault, but there you are. So an example of this is, let's say one of your good buddies has a boyfriend that you have never met. Your buddy wants you to know how great their boyfriend is, of course, if they really like them, how the guy is very kind, loving, caters to their every need, that sort of thing. These are things that we are told about them. Unless your friend, your buddy, is a bad judge of character, you can usually assume that they're correct. Thus, you have a mental image of this good person. And then one day, you are introduced to the boyfriend. And they're exactly the way your friend described. The boyfriend holds the door open for you, compliments you, pretends you're interesting, that sort of thing. This experience, what you've been told, reinforce one another, and you wholeheartedly believe that he is a good guy. And we don't just do this with people. We also do it with a lot of animate objects. If you do it with inanimate objects, you probably have a problem. But one of the examples is we do it with animals. And if you've ever met a friend, then they have like a dog, and you're going to go see the dog. It's like, oh, Rover is such a nice dog, and he loves everybody. And you get there, and it wants to kill you. You're like, no, it wants to kill me. One of these pieces of information is misleading, obviously. And at this point, you kind of have to develop what's going on here. You know, either your friend is an idiot and doesn't know anything about their dog, or, you know, maybe you showed up and when you walked in the door, you just scared the dog. And it just, you know, was a little frightened, but next time you see him, it might be better. And to go back to examples of people, I read a story recently of a lady who was on a very long plane trip, and she tried several times to make friendly conversation with the man she sat next to, but he just ignored her completely. So she thought the man was very rude, and when they landed, the man tried to push his way out of the airplane. And when the stewardess asked him to wait, he told her that he was in a rush to make the funerals for his wife and children, who had died a few days earlier in a car crash. And, you know, suddenly, this man who was a jerk, you know, they become a little less of a jerk. And I talk about this because we do it with God, too. We learn things in Sunday school. We talk to people about God, and we are exhorted at meetings, just among a few ways we can learn about God. And we also have experiences with God. And you may be saying to yourself right now that you've never met God. I haven't met God. God has never directly spoken to me. Abraham talked with God. Moses talked with God. But God has never directly talked with me. But he does interact with us in some way. And there are arguments of how involved God is with the details and the experiences of your life. There's a term called clockwork universe that was used around the days of the Revolutionary War by like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, where God had set up the world and just went hands off, just kind of let it roll. And there's obviously evidence that he didn't do that, such as miracles, the flood, and whatnot. So God is somehow involved, and some people believe that God's really intricately involved. And I can't argue that either way, but we know he is involved in some way, shape, or form. And you probably guess in your head, in fact, we were discussing this last night after even program, how he interacts with you. Something happens to you and you attribute it to God and His will. Like when you get a raise, you may think it's God giving you His blessing. And the problem with you thinking these things is that God's involvement, or whether or not He is or was, the thing is or was God's will, is completely subjective. You don't know how God was involved, whether you wanted it to happen or not. Whether He made it happen or not, and most importantly, why He let it happen. But we still do it. And it can be a very bad thing. It can be good if you think that God was the reason behind your raise or any other blessing in your life, and that makes you think that God is showing His love for you, then that is great. You know, it's great to know and to feel that God loves you. But it can also be very bad. Bad things happen too. And we wonder why they happen. And usually Christians encourage each other by saying that these things are God's will and that God is using it for good to help us and or others into the kingdom. And why people don't always do this tactfully, they are correct in their thinking. And we know that from Romans chapter 8, verse 28, that for those who love God and all things work together for good. But sometimes those bad things really hurt. Sometimes bad things keep happening. Sometimes people can't catch a break. Sometimes it gets worse. And maybe you wonder, why is God doing this? Is God punishing me? Do I need to learn something? Why can't I learn it? Is He chastising me to perfect me? And maybe then God starts to seem less caring. And maybe He begins to seem less merciful. And maybe God seems to be too overbearing. Maybe you start to want to break from God, even if you still think you love Him. And that's where you really don't want to be. And that's when you need to wonder if it's God who's really trying to chastise you or punish you, or even wonder if He's letting it happen to you as opposed to making it happen to you. And this is when you need to embrace that God knows what He's doing, and you don't know exactly what He is doing or how involved He is. And the point of this is we can't use the same relationship mechanisms on God that we can on man, because we don't know exactly what He's doing. And we have to be aware of this because we do it. And it can change God in our minds, this mental picture of who He is, into something that He isn't. All we can assume is what we're told about Him, and we have to hold to that. We can't define who God is based on how we think He is interacting with us. And again, I hope that none of you are having problems with God, but if you are, talk to people about Him. Look for the good, have faith in what you learn, and try to see that God is trying to have a good relationship with you by looking at what He has promised us. And however you say it in your own mind, I really hope that you want to show God that you love Him. Thank you.